Jonathan Trigg is my guest this week. My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Now, Jonathan did archaeology at Lampeter in the mid to late 1990s, and for the last 22 years, he's been at Liverpool. Now, we talk about the advantages of a small campus. He was brought up in Essex. He talks about how and why he decided to apply to university, being a late developer. We talk about our relationship with the past and his work on war memorials and how some people are going to be more deserving of our praise than others. Now, from growing up, he remembers watching cricket with his father. We discussed the 1981 royal wedding. He also remembers the love of family and then discovering, after going to university, that he had the chance to become himself. Jonathan doesn't have a mobile phone. We talk about the benefits, or otherwise, of doing everything online, teaching-wise, due to lockdown. He appreciates the time that his tutors took to give him and others to learn. And we talk about the importance of feedback. We learn how Jonathan ended up in academia, why he feels that in some ways it is a hobby. Now, he relays what happened when he saw the film Gladiator at the cinema with a Roman archaeology and history lecturer who had a problem with some facets of the film. Now, he talks about voting for the first time while a student, playing for the student cricket team. And Jonathan learned life experience at Lampeter and academic experience at Liverpool. Now, when asked at a young age what he wanted to be when he was older, his answer would have been a museum curator. Now, he talks about how good it is when people go on to do things because of your efforts, and he finishes with a reference to the Welsh Hiraeth. It was so good to catch up for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews with Jonathan Trigg. My name is Chris Deasy. Okay, well, it is such a pleasure to have Jonathan Trigg for my latest nostalgia interview. And Jonathan, we kind of know each other, but also don't know each other because we went to the same university. And of course, we've been in touch over the last month or so. Do you want to say a little bit, Jonathan, about who you are and where you're living at the moment?
Well, first of all, thank you, Chris, for having me, as it were, you know, in these sort of stringent times. I suppose we know each other from Lampeter, where I did my undergraduate degree in archaeology. I was there between 1995 and 98. I then had a year out. I then went to Liverpool, the University at Liverpool, and did a master's degree in archaeology, which is where I've been ever since. You know, having planned to be in Liverpool for just a year, I've been here for 22. So that's where I am at the moment. I've had spells at Glasgow University, doing some teaching and some research there, but Liverpool's where I seem to be at the moment.
Yeah, and of course Lampeter. It was funny because after we spoke, this is an interesting confession to make. Now we're on air, but I went into one of my old diaries because I digitized my diaries years ago, and I thought I know I knew Jonathan, but I couldn't remember where. Anyway, I tapped your name in, and there was a reference one evening to I think it was the King's Head in Lampeter, and there was Rob, who's the mayor of Lampeter, and
Rob Phillips, yes. Friends.
So it looked like a very nice evening. And in those days, I didn't write very much, but it sounded as though we had a very similar set of friends, and although we were in very different departments, it's very clear that we really did know the same people.
Well, that's the nature about Lampeter. There were so many different people from different sort of backgrounds and from different sort of whether it be physical backgrounds, whether it be academic backgrounds, you know, friends who are in history department, friends who are in English, philosophy, and so on. And I think that's one of the one things that I really appreciated about Lampeter was the fact that you could have so many different perspectives on life coming in and to, for example, the King's Head, to go into into that, and you'd have sort of a great sort of group of people having their own perspectives on life who would give you these opinions, and that was nice. I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I think you're right, because in some places, you know, you can go to the most fantastic, exotic places in the world. I'm not saying Lampeter wasn't one of them, but you can go somewhere and you kind of feel you're in the middle of this sort of, you know, cosmopolitan area, but you don't know anybody. But in Lampeter, it kind of felt the world came to Lampeter. You didn't have to go to the world came to you. And I always found it very odd that, and quite amusing really, that by day I'd look out of my window and I'd see a lot of the people associated with, you know, some of the different communities, some of the different traditions and departments. You'd have the people in the Islamic department or the Confucius Institute all around the town. And I thought, gosh, you know, in this small Welsh market town, we've got people here from every corner of the world. And then by night, sometimes you'd see some of, you know, some of the more local people. And you sometimes think, what an interesting juxtaposition, you know, that the world has settled on this small town. And, you know, and some of the academics obviously stay a very long time. I was there for 10 years. But it's just always very interesting that you realise through those evenings at the King's Head and others that you learn so much about people. And 20 years, or even now, let's be honest, in my case, it's 30 years on, because I went to Lampeter in October 1991. Those conversations in the quarry or the student union or the pubs or the cafes around town have stuck with me, because they were conversations with people giving advice and help and just supporting each other academically and personally. And all these decades on, I'm still indebted to those people for, you know, helping ensure, and I like to think that it's mutual, but, you know, for putting me on the right course.
And I'd agree with you on that, because it's the people that I sort of still have these conversations with are some of my closest friends, and they remain that, not because they've known me for my entire life, but they've known me for that particular 3-year period, which was so important in sort of developing me as a person, and probably developing lots of people as as their people. You know, it really is important in that sense.
And have you found in that sense that, you know, university's changed? Because obviously as a teacher now rather than a student, but do you kind of miss those days of having your whole life and, you know, the student experience ahead, when, as it certainly was in my case, I just kind of felt that it's almost as though at the age of 18, the reset button was pressed. Yeah. Although I'm now in touch with a lot of friends from school, I wasn't until a few years ago, but I kind of felt that for me, life started at 18.
University life from a campus-based university like Lampeter, and contrasting that with somewhere like Liverpool or Glasgow, where you're in a much bigger city, you sort of build different networks of friendship, for want of a better term, that pretty much, you know, when I was in Lampeter, if something went wrong, someone would be there to say, you know, why haven't you turned up to this meeting, or, you know, are you unwell, or this kind of thing. Whereas that's totally different in a city like Liverpool, in that sense. And I think that what I have noticed in the past 20 years at Liverpool has been that people they change their sort of connections based on their connections are based more on sort of subject level. In the university anyway. I mean, that's where I get to know the students from. They know their student friends who are in their, you know, in their classes, in their, in their lectures and that kind of thing. And not so much outside of that basis. Whereas in Lampeter, for example, where people were sort of a bit more sort of homogenized, for want of a better term, they were from all sorts of backgrounds, all sorts of central groups in that sense, and that's the big difference I notice. You know,
yeah. And in terms of how the journey started for you, where were you brought up?
I was brought up from in Essex. I'm an Essex boy at heart, when I was doing my A levels, I sort of got a sort of real conflict when it came to choosing what I would do for my degree, because I always knew I was interested in the past, not necessarily the historical past, but, you know, it could be the classical past, the archaeological past, and that sort of sense. So I was sort of really struck when I was choosing where I would apply to university. And I was struck that I could do a classics degree, I could do a history degree, an ancient history degree, or an archaeology degree. So I sort of basically ended up sort of applying pretty much everywhere and getting in nowhere, because I was never a really good student. And I've always been a sort of a late developer in that sense. When it came to doing my, I remember quite vividly as a sort of 17, 18 year old, sort of thinking, actually, this is really rather interesting. Why haven't I studied it before? And then thinking, yes, you have studied it before, you idiot. You've just learnt that you actually appreciate it. So that was never the case. So I sort of fell into Lampeter because I didn't get into any of the places I'd applied to. I'd applied to Reading, to Birmingham. I never got into those places because I didn't have the academic requirements. And so I fell into Lampeter because it was a choice between Lampeter, Aberystwyth and Cardiff. And Cardiff, they wanted me to do politics, which I was never interested in. I didn't want to do that. So I ended up between Lampeter doing archaeology and Aberystwyth doing history. And I chose the archaeology because that was the sort of biggest sort of draw for me. And that mistake, for want of a better term, was the best mistake I've ever made in my entire life in that sense, because it brought me to where I am now. And you see, the corollary to that is then following on from that, I then never knew after doing 3 years of archaeology at Lampeter that I actually wanted to do archaeology as a career. And then I decided I actually wanted to do further research. So I then went on to look at places that would do MAs in archaeology. And I got a place here at Liverpool. The idea was that I'd be here for a year and then move on after that, choose another career after that. But I've been here ever since. So it's purely purely accidental, really. You know?
Yeah, and I was interested in what you just said about nostalgia. Well, or at least I'm going to put nostalgia out there. But you mentioned the past and the way that we engage with the past and whether it's the classical past, the historical past. But also, I think in terms of nostalgia, there's also the very personal past. I mean, I suppose there is a question, and it's one that I've been grappling with about, you know, can you be nostalgic for something that you didn't yourself experience? I mean, I suppose you could be. I suppose you could be nostalgic for a particular period in history that you didn't live through, but maybe wished that you had. I suppose that's why people have war memorabilia and so on. You know, it's completely understandable that you might do that. But nostalgia often is very personal. And I find that kick-started my work on nostalgia to a large extent was this sense that there were missing pieces of the jigsaw when it came to my own life. It's the whole sort of what if. It's a midlife crisis, I suppose, as much as anything else. But that whole sense of thinking, oh, you know, what if I cultivated those friendships or those connections, those networks a little bit more, which is not then to say that you necessarily have huge regrets, but you do sometimes feel that maybe as you get a bit older and sometimes a bit more confident in what you do, that you might have done or wish that you'd done things a bit differently. Do you ever have some of those kind of experiences?
Oh, plenty. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you learn as an archaeologist, for example, that you end up doing these short-term projects, you know, that last sort of a couple of months here, a couple of months there, and you end up meeting people that you've met and you never see them again after that 2 week period or that 2 month period or whatever it is. And you suddenly realize I would like to meet those people again, you know, in that sense. But the nature of the past is that we can only look on it backwards, you know. I've done a lot of research looking at war memorials and essentially all that we do is look at the war memorials with a sort of rose-tinted spectacles. These were the wonderful people who gave our lives, gave their lives for us, you know, and so on. But that inevitably is not the case. You know, inevitably there are going to be some people who were far more deserving of our praise than others, you know, but that's the way things, you know, that's the nature of looking back at the past, you know.
Yeah, and in terms of growing up as well, what are your earliest memories, Jonathan? You mentioned that you were an Essex boy, but what do you remember from childhood?
My earliest memories, and certainly the ones that sort of propel me into where I am at the moment, is you're watching cricket with my father, and this must have been sort of in the early 80s, going down to the Essex cricket ground. We'd just moved to a new house, when my sister was born. She's 3 years younger than I am. And so we just moved down. It must have been sort of 1981, something like that. It must have been before then, actually, because I remember doing various activities associated with the royal wedding from 1981. But my earliest memories that really sort of really emphasise what where I am today is going down to see the cricket with my father after 5 o'clock, because it was free entry, you see. So he'd come home from work and would take me down, and we'd go and watch the cricket for the last hour or so of the game, because it was free entry. You know, so it's very much sort of family orientated in that sense.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the royal wedding, because I've got very, I'm not going to say vivid, because I'm sure they're composite memories and probably all very sort of muddy now. But I remember the 81 royal wedding very much. I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And I've got, and the thing that I particularly remember is we all had to gather in school in front of just to the side of the porter cabin, I think it was, where we were taught in that particular year.
Yes.
And the head teacher stood on the bank looking down on us and spoke about the upcoming wedding. And we were all given commemorative spoons, Charles and Diana. Well, I don't think I've still got it, but my parents have. And I think they put it in their china cabinet for probably still there, to be honest.
It's funny you should say that, because it reminds me of the I think my parents had a couple of glasses that had 1977 inscribed on them from the Silver Jubilee. And but no, it was 1981 that I remember, because my sister and I were both made to dress up as King and Queen of Hearts, as part of a street parade, a street party.
And it's funny. And also, of course, because at the time that was seen to be, when I was that age, I had limited experience of weddings, or certainly royal weddings, but certainly it was a big deal. We had street parties. And also, that was the funny thing I remember. I vaguely remember I was 4 at the time of the Silver Jubilee. So I do remember 1977 a little bit, but the 81 wedding as well, street parties. And of course, I would have known very little about what the reason why we were there exactly, but it was an opportunity for us all to sit, and everybody made cakes or sausage rolls and goodness knows whatever else, and catered for all the children in the street. And it really stuck with me. And I guess that marriage didn't last, but a decade on, there was almost that sense of something, some innocence somehow that was captured all the more so by that event, because of course, nobody anticipated how horribly it would all go for them. But there's this memory, and I don't know if the other people in the street where I grew up have still have those memories. I'm sure they probably long since forgotten me, etc. But just all sitting there sharing an experience, and it was something that we only ever did on those sort of occasions, which were very few and far between. So it's interesting that the way that the future and that the collapse of that marriage and all the other things that obviously happened to Diana somehow all sort of crystallized in this sort of before the fall type reminiscence when I was 7 years of age.
Yeah, I completely understand that. Those sort of theoretical sort of nodes sort of impact on people straight away, and it's something that you always sort of fix on, or fixate on, perhaps, some would say.
And what about other things that you obviously enjoyed cricket, but are there any other things from childhood that kind of have lasted with you over your lifetime, whether it could be things that you used to write down, or I used to be obsessed with writing the charts down, and I still got the book with all of those sort of entries, but are there things that, like, whether it's film or music or indeed sport, that you carried through?
Yes. No, I sort of... I really sort of enjoyed sort of hearing about you talk about how you used to, when you were listening to the charts and press record and then stop recording when the DJ came on, who I always thought they're only coming on to stop you recording that, and I used to do the same thing. I never used to keep a diary in that sense, because I thought, well, who's interested in what I've got to think about, and if anyone, it's me, and I've already got those thoughts. So that wasn't an issue in that sense. But I did enjoy sort of hearing you saying exactly those sort of sort of things that I was thinking of. I think in terms of my sort of upbringing, if you like, my childhood. That's the the love of sport that my father had was important. I think the other thing that I would mention is that it's a family thing. You know, it's a love of family, which is so important. And I sort of, when I went to Lampeter, I sort of moved away from that. I sort of this was my sort of first time away from family, yeah. And so I was basically making my own sort of personality, in the sense that I was cooking for myself, looking after myself, having to deal with day to day basis is like bills and this kind of thing. Everything was done for me up to the point when I went to Lampeter, and then I had to deal with it for myself. So I then started to learn who I was as a person, as opposed to the person that I was that my family or my parents had made me. And I think that that's quite significant and important in my life. And the reason I say that, I mean, that's not to be any disrespectful to my parents, but they've made themselves the people that they wanted me to be, and I actually wanted me to be me, and so going to Lampeter was that, going to university was that kind of breaking free moment, as it were.
Yeah, I think people today find it a lot easier, and I find this interesting how children today, and maybe it's a generational thing, but it does seem that the concept of following your dreams does seem to be something that is actualized or deemed to be achievable, in the sense that at school, also in terms of the way people express themselves, and it can happen in terms of sexuality as well, but there's just a different kind of ethos these days that you want to encourage students to bring out their potential.
That's I understand that and the one thing I would say in addition to that is that when students come to me and say, well, I want to go and do a master's, what do you recommend? Where do you recommend? I say pretty much two things. First of all, don't go to where you're close to in terms of your, in terms of your family, because you'll learn who you are. And that's what I learned from Lampeter, going to be where I was, by accident rather than choice. The other thing I would say is go somewhere where you haven't done your first degree, because you will then learn your opinions. Because it's very easy to go to an opinionated university, for example, where someone says, X is Y, A is B, and everyone will, follow that diktat. Well, I think you've got to make your own opinions, certainly within the world of arts and humanities anyway. Yeah. And that's my view. It's not necessarily that you don't agree with what I think of, but argue it for the argument that it is. That would be where I go from. So yes, go somewhere which is away from your university, away from your parents, away from your family, because that's the way you sort of learn. That's the way you sort of grow as a person, in my view.
Yeah, I think that's really well put, because I think in my case, going to university was an amazing thing and a life-changing thing. But also then I stayed. And in many respects, you could say on paper, I achieved all these different subsequent degrees. And it was, you can make a case for saying that was a really, really solid period. But also there was a sense of not taking the kind of risks that perhaps now, all these decades on, in my late 40s, I can start to think, that's interesting, because the things I wanted to do when I was a bit younger, I still want to do them. But maybe I'm too old, or you can look at it and say, I'm not so sure. In other words, am I happy with my life? In many respects, yes. But there's always that thing niggling away, and you think, well, isn't it, even if it doesn't work out, at least I'll know one way or the other. Sometimes the idea of something is better than the actuality. Sometimes, of course, it's nice to have unattainable dreams, because once you attain them, you realise that how deflating they are. You think, oh, that was it. I spent all my life wanting to do this thing, and now that I've done it, what an anticlimax. Like going to Hawaii, which I didn't, you know, think, oh, you know, it's going to be the best thing, and it's the closest thing to heaven. When you go there, it's very nice, but it was never going to, you know, meet that sort of expectation. So if I'd never gone, I'd still have this, I'd be putting it on a pedestal. But now it's come off the pedestal. That's not to disparage it at all. It was just that I was imagining it was going to be something completely otherworldly. And in many ways it was. But I think I'd overly inflated its sense of worth.
Well, that's the nature, in a sense, of reflecting backwards. You can only reflect backwards. You can only think about how things happened as they happened. You know, and you can't go back and think, well, maybe I haven't gone to Lampeter, maybe I've gone to Nottingham, say, or Birmingham or wherever. You can only sort of say, well, I actually went to Lampeter and this is what happened. And this is what happened as a result of that. Yeah. And so I would always be sort of very grateful for Lampeter for that, you know, for that sort of particular nature. Just like I would say, if I'd gone to Reading, say, I'd have say, well, I'm grateful to Reading for this kind of, personal trait in that sense.
Yeah, do you find it as well really interesting how you often find yourself, maybe unconsciously, but defining yourself and others, you know, through things like Facebook, but just the fact that you're in touch with people from 30 years ago, as well as the people you're in touch with now, and often they have dialogues with each other through your posts, etc. And you just look at it and you think, this is interesting. It's like your past and your present coming into some sort of into a conversation. And that's unheard of. You know, 30 years ago, you'd be in Lampeter and you'd be with the people. Yeah, we had telephones in those days. We took you up to use them. But really, you know, you'd be stuck with a particular community of people and you got to know them really well. But then when you left that community, you might go back to your parents' house or you'd go on to a job or et cetera. And then, of course, you take on new friendships. But the great thing sometimes when you're a bit older and you sort of bring all those different parts of your past together is that you start inevitably to do a lot of the kind of reflecting that we've been touching on.
Yes, yeah, and that's really rather important. But people always say to me, "Well, what's your mobile phone number?" I don't have a mobile phone. I've never had a mobile phone. I had one when I was at Lampeter, ironically enough, but I don't have a mobile phone. And they say, "Well, how do you cope?" Well, and I think so. Well, we've learned for thousands of years how to cope without mobile phones, and you can't manage to get the idea that I don't have a mobile phone into your head. It's ridiculous in that sense, you know. Mm-hmm. So I do, I think we develop, and I suppose maybe having mobile phones, tablets, laptops, computers, everything is part of that. But I don't think we should always forget that. There are certain sort of smaller elements that we have to think about, less sort of technological elements.
And you're right that the technology could do two things. It can certainly facilitate things like teaching. Wow. I mean, through lockdown, Zoom teaching, obviously now via Zoom, it's incredible. I don't know how we would have managed a few decades ago. Somebody said to me once, we'd have to have done something via radio or some way that, you know, would have been a completely different way of communicating, and it wouldn't have been dialogical in the same way. But the other extreme of it is that you're right, we're beholden to technology to the point that, you know, you can, I mean, there are pluses and minuses to it, but you can be anywhere in the world and you can be reachable. And that's always interesting.
If I may turn the tables on you in a sense and say, have you found problems with your teaching over the internet?
Enjoyed it far more, and I think my students have as well, because obviously we have those conversations. And Jonathan, it's a really good question, because at the beginning of lockdown, I thought, I've only ever taught in front of a community of students in a classroom. And my heart sank when I'd never heard of Zoom other than the Zoom mic that I use for my podcast. But when I was told, oh, you know, with immediate effect, just teach online, I was like, I'm in my office at work. I've got to teach online. How do I do that? I thought, that doesn't make any sense. How can I translate teaching my undergraduate students into an online thing? But of course, in due course, I learn how to do that. And of course, I think I then started to see the opportunity for doing it this way. But also, this was the problem as well. I'd only ever worked on campus. So to suddenly find yourself like at home in your, I don't know, your twin's bedroom or something, and then teaching your students from there at 9 o'clock in the morning, that was odd. And if you'd said to me 2 years ago that I'd be doing that, I would have just said, you know, because I never used Skype before, unless I had to, but I didn't use it regularly. My parents don't have the internet, so it's similar to what you were saying. They have a mobile phone, but they don't have a smartphone, so they literally just use it for calls. So the thought of teaching using a different form of technology, yeah, I thought it was going to be a huge struggle, but surprisingly, I've seen the benefits. I mean, what was your experience, Jonathan?
Well, actually, first of all, I was exactly the same as you, and so quite sort of opposed to this whole, come on, you can't teach people other than face to face. But one of the things I have really found useful is that I can send people things early, and they can sort of engage with, say, documents or quotes from a particular author, or and so I can say, right, you've read that quote, what's your reaction to it? Or you've seen that source, what's your reaction to it? So from that point of view, it's actually been very, very helpful. And yes, there are sort of negatives and back, you know, problems down, you're saying to, you can't always see what people are doing and teaching in that sense. But I've actually really, I've grown to it in a sense, you know, and I think it's a very good way to go forward, if I'm honest, because you can actually get your teaching to a wider audience, you know. And so I've sort of spoken to people who are saying, well, I've been doing this teaching and, well, here we are, so in my case, based in Liverpool, but I've got people who are doing courses in Leeds, in Manchester, places that we wouldn't normally be reaching out to because of the geographical nature of it. You know, they can't come into Liverpool for a lecture, but they can tune in, as it were, via via a computer. So it has plenty of benefits, and that's what I would say.
Yeah, and in that sense, do you sort of look back on your teaching as an undergraduate in Lampeter, and do you kind of see now, out of necessity, like completely new ways of channeling and disseminating that sort of, you know, stuff? I mean, has it completely galvanized, changed your way of understanding the whole delivery of teaching at university level?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question, because it raises a lot of sub questions. So I don't want to spend too long to sort of bore you with an answer. I mean, first of all, I would say the way I was taught was the way that everyone was taught, and that's the only thing that we were used to. So from that perspective, everyone was subjected to the same sort of teaching, good or bad, and of course some of the lecturers that I had, and probably you had as well, were good. Some were atrocious, but that's not the nature of the thing. It's everyone was, you know, teaching within their own sort of interests. I got a lot more as an undergraduate, I would say, from individual teaching, supervisions or seminars, where the person didn't have to sort of stick to a sort of script, as it were. And I've always enjoyed teaching in the same way. And perhaps it's because I enjoyed it so much that that's what I enjoy teaching, you know, that, you know, when you can sort of just have a subject and you just discuss that subject, rather than having someone at the other end of the line saying, well, it's going to be on the exam, will this be in an essay or whatever. I much rather enjoy sort of just sort of sitting there and talking to someone who's interested in the subject, and therefore we can sort of go off on all these tangents, you know, without having to say, well, I've got to teach you this within an hour, or whatever the time frame is. And that's what I always got from Lampeter, because when I was a student, the lecturers were always keen and willing, and most important, willing to give you that time. to sort of spend, you know, going through an essay, going through an answer. And I remember one of them saying to me, well, it was nice of you to actually come and get the feedback, because lots of people just say, get the feedback. I've got the grade. That's all I'm interested in. And one of the things that they said to me was it was nice to be able to explain why you got the grade, why you'd got that. And that's always what has sort of stuck with me in that sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that that's something that I've really taken forward, that it's the feedback, which actually in so many ways is so much the most important thing, because if a student just looks at the mark and doesn't read the feedback, then what's going to happen? The next essay, they'll just do the same thing all over again. Yes. I remember before, it wasn't where I am now, but many years ago, after Lampeter, when I was working elsewhere, I remember reading a student essay, which felt like a succession of bullet points. In fact, the only thing missing was actually the bullet points themselves. It was red, red. You know, it was just like a shopping list should be. And, and the student, you know, and I thought, well, you know, don't. If, there are some like good things here, but they're not developed. They're just like, it's just like a list of things. And I thought, if you turn the, you know, anyway, so I gave her the feedback, and anyway, next essay, she did the same thing. So I thought, okay, what do you do with this? Because, you know, at the end of the day, and well, there are lots of ways of helping a student to, you know, and we have the infrastructure in place, but it is interesting, because the feedback isn't always read. And I do take it personally when that's the case, because you think, well, I'm writing this, but probably for two people, maybe three, actually. One is the student, the other is the external examiner, and actually the other one is me, because also in giving that feedback, if I'm going to write a reference for that student in 3 years' time, as I often do, well, I need to go back over my notes. So the more detailed the sort of the material is, then the more confident and comfortable I am writing a reference. So they are useful, but if the student, the primary beneficiary, is not making the most of that, then you feel they're wasting to some extent their degree.
And I always say to the student, come and see me if you want to get some feedback on these comments, because frankly, at the end of the day, you know, a written comment is only as much as it's it's a mark on the pen. Come and see me if you've got a query, and number of people that don't come and see me is far more than the number of people that do, and I find that rather upsetting in a sense. And you know, I spent time reading and marking your essay. Well, you might as well at least get sort of some kind of comment on it. And then when it comes to the later stage, you say, well, yes, you have come and seen me and sort of got some your feedback on your essay. Well, it makes a greater impression, surely, from the point of view of the person that's writing the reference, for example, in your case, you know. So I always sort of make that sort of emphasis. So say, come and see me, see why I've given you 47 or whatever it is, you know, that you've got.
Yeah. And I guess related to that, Jonathan, is the question of what inspired you to enter academia? I mean, it's obviously you did a degree and you went and did a master's. Was it a design? Was it happenstance? Was it accident that you ended up continuing to work in this profession?
Well, it certainly wasn't a design. It was purely something that grew on me, in a sense. And it grew on me in the different sort of phases of academia, if you like, in so much as that when I came to to Liverpool, I never really intended to stay in academia, but I found that I enjoyed teaching and getting across the information that I have to other people, which is what teaching is all about. But then I didn't actually... I then found that I actually enjoyed more than teaching. I actually enjoyed the research aspect of it. And that's where I am at the moment. So it's sort of one of those things that sort of I've sort of crawled into it, you know. None of it has been through plan, choice, or anything like that. It's just the way it's happened. And I'm quite pleased with that, because it's just evolved and I've evolved as a person at the same point of time. And then you see, that's where you sort of begin to say, well actually I'm feeling self important, but I'm actually pretty good at this, and I can do what I can do. I can tell people what I'm enthused about, and one does automatically you must find that it's easy to talk about things that you are particularly enthusiastic about. And it's the same for me, because the what I'm enthusiastic about is what I'm researching or studying at the moment, regardless of what that is. And I'm very lucky in the sense that what I'm doing is no more than my hobby. If I wasn't doing it for a job, I'd be doing it for on a weekend, saying, "Well, I file papers at the weekend. At the weekend, I go and do some research. That's my hobby is my job. So I find myself very lucky in that respect."
Yeah, no, and I think that's the funny thing to people outside of this profession. Who don't understand why you don't take? I mean, my own children sort of say, "Daddy, but don't you like want to go on holiday?" Because of course, it's a bit like a busman's holiday. Sometimes I feel that when I go on holiday, that normally means I go around the country interviewing people for my podcast. And of course, my children think, "But Daddy, that's just so strange. You're always on the laptop all day. Don't you want to have a proper holiday?"
And I might say, you can't beat that as an archaeologist or historian, because there's always history around you. There's always something, and because I'm a butterfly mind kind of person, that's why I get nothing done. That's interesting. I'd go off on that sort of tangent, but there is no such thing as a turn off button. There's no switch off. Turn off button in that sense.
Yeah, and actually, in a way, you're right, and it can be very fulfilling if you. I mean, I do it with my film reviews and my interviews as well. I keep enough things going, and I never know anymore what's work and what's not. I think it's because I make it work in some ways, literally make it work. In a way that all the things I do in some way are related to different facets of what I do.
Well, I've sort of followed a few things that you said about the films that you watch. And I sort of watch a lot of films. The films that I watch are sort of historical or military in basis. And I try and find the ability not to create conflict in them. Say, "Oh gosh, this is awfully wrong. This is terrible." You've got to sort of have that sort of period of detachment. And I sort of remember going to see Gladiator when it first came out in the cinema. And I went with a friend of mine who's a lecturer in Roman archaeology and history. And he sort of sat there chuntering through the whole, "Oh, that's not the kind of uniform they would have worn. That's not the kind of armor. That's the wrong kind of weapon or whatever." Goodness sake, just watch the film. that whole thing was that, I should like to have that sort of period of detachment where you can say, "Well, just enjoy it as a piece of fiction," and get over that sort of nonsense.
Well, absolutely, the way that sometimes filmmakers portray academics, it's laughable, because yes. I watch a good example. The Mirror Has Two Faces. Barbara Streisand, she's teaching her students, and I think, nobody I know teaches like that, but she's and it's not like a formal lecture. She's talking about love. And she's like a literature professor. She goes off on one and it becomes about herself. And her students are all listening very attentively. And then one of them will say something at the back and she knows their names. And I'm thinking, I'd love to go to a lecture like that. But that's not, lectures are a bit more boring in many ways. Don't get me wrong. Although after watching that scene, I thought, "Well, maybe I should jazz my lectures." but also the way they portray theologians. And they're always people. And this is the funny thing, because it's almost like the elephant in the room. But it's about the way that they portray people with faith. But when you've got like Denzel Washington in the film Fallen, and he goes to to try and find out about this demon, so he goes to a theologian, and she says the very thing that a theologian at a university lecturer would never say to somebody who asked them a question. And he says, "Do you believe in God, Mr. Hobbes," or whatever. And it's like, and I just thought, you'd never say that, like, to our students. If a student asks me a question, if I'm doing a course on death and the afterlife, I'm never going to start asking them whether they believe.
"Oh, do you believe in God, Dr. DC?" It's a bit like in archaeology, we sort of have the same. Everyone thinks we're Indiana Jones, or yes, let's be fair. Lots of people, I mean, there were sort of, you could probably trace the the number of people taking degrees in archaeology through, say, about 1981 when Indiana Jones came out, and then when Time Team came out, and there'd be a peak then. And the number of times I've seen, we've seen this on Time Team, and why can't you do that? Well, they've got millions of pounds to spend on it. We don't. Doesn't seem to sort of factor into their conversations. But there are these sort of, it's really sort of important sort of phases of interest in a subject, based on these sort of impractical moments.
And before we get to some more, shall we say, philosophically based questions, what about your time as a student? Things, whether it's with sport, politics, religion, voting, radio, are there any things, and that's obviously, I'm just throwing a few things out there, just, you know.
That's quite a lot.
Anything that particularly sort of like sums up that particular period of your life?
Well, okay, sport, politics, religion, voting. So voting wise, I mean, I voted for the first time when I was an undergraduate, and had my own opinions at the first time as an undergraduate in that sense. Sport wise, I was very involved in the student union at the time. And I was lucky enough to get selected to play for, if I say lucky enough, I was there. I actually got to, I played for the Boosa cricket teams, you know, so I got my colours from the university for that, in that sense. And that was more a case of not any kind of sporting ability, more that I was available. I turned up on time. So yes, I look on my time as a student as being sort of moist, dewy-eyed, and that kind of thing. Yes, I do. It's the simple thing. I remember speaking to friends that we have in common, and would I go back to Lampeter as a lecturer? And the answer is that at the time I would have said yes, with regard to the location, the philosophy, if you like, the gestalt of Lampeter as it was. Would I go there as would I necessarily choose to go into academia nowadays is another question. Yes, I had sort of fantastic memories of Lampeter, but the memories were not academic. My academic memories come from Liverpool, if I'm honest, because I think the nub of the question is that when I was at Lampeter, I learnt life experience. When I was at Liverpool, now I am at Liverpool, I've learnt academic experience, and that's the difference between the two. It sort of relates back to what I was saying earlier about having fallen into the situation that I'm in. I'm not particularly talented or whatever. I've just got to where I am because of happenstance, as you put it. And that's what I would say. I'm not particularly brilliant or specialist in my subject, but I do what I do, and I do it as best as I can, and I think I do it pretty well. So
absolutely. Well, that comes out. And also, of course, if you are doing a good job, well, you know, not just because you have an overinflated sense of self-worth, but because the students are telling you, you would know. There's no way you can't go decades in a profession and be completely deluded, I would like to think. That's anyway right. he says hopefully. But what about following up some of those points there about memories being positive, or indeed you mentioned dewy-eyed sort of reminiscences of Lampeter, but to what extent would you say then, Jonathan, that your, well, two questions really, are your memories predominantly positive? You've kind of answered that, but can you be nostalgic about negative experiences?
First of all, yes, I would say that my memories are positive. Perhaps the reasoning for that is because they are positive. And it's a bit like saying, well, you remember the good things. And I remember lots of good things about Lampeter, and probably decided to forget or have forgotten lots of bad things that are just the same. In that sense, and that probably goes some way to answering your second question, which is that memory is such a thing that it is, it is positive. And I deal with a lot of memory in my academic career, which has dealt with memory, particularly of the war dead, that we memorialize, we commemorate people who have died in the flower of their youth, 21 years old, for example, they haven't had the opportunity to do anything wrong, in a sense. So from that point of view, their memory is sort of conflated to that level. And I also think that, we all assume that that when we talk about the memory of the dead from the First World War, for example, that it's all a commemoration of heroism, great sort of strength and so on. But actually, it's not always the case, and there's lots of individual stories that have not got that kind of level of commemoration. Now, to move on to the question, which is, do I think that you can commemorate or can you be nostalgic about bad experiences? I think the answer is yes, you can be nostalgic about them, but we choose not to. I choose not to anyway, and that's probably a failing in my perspective, but I don't think we do choose to be nostalgic about. We are nostalgic about what we actually remember as being good. We forget the bad things, but remember the positive. And is that a bad thing? I'm not sure that it is.
That's right, because in some ways, of course, something that's bad at the time might turn out to be surprisingly good for us, in the sense that an exam. I mean my driving test. The driving test was the worst thing, because I actually, in Lampeter, I passed on the fourth attempt, and I had the same examiner each time, so I was in tears on the by number three. So it was a horrible experience. But now I love driving, but it took me about 20 years after passing my test, or 13 anyway, before I was even remotely comfortable getting in a car. So in a funny way, I can look back now and say, yeah, the experience was bad, but it led to something really good.
Yeah, it can work out in that respect. And it reminds me of a story that my aunt told me about when she learned to drive, as you were mentioning driving. She'd failed the first time, and maybe the second time, I can't remember. But the third time, she thought she'd failed because she'd made an error, and she decided, well, blow it, I'm going to show this chap I can drive. And she passed with flying colours because of the fact that she totally dismissed all of those previous thoughts. And that was the difference, so that, it can work in your favour.
And looking back on the younger you, say you're 5 or you're 15 would that younger self perhaps be surprised to see what you're doing now?
Well, definitely, because as I say earlier, I've never really imagined being in this position of doing what I'm doing. I never really knew what I was going to be doing at the age of 15 or 5 or whatever. I remember sort of being as a child and being asked by adults and parents or whatever, and say, well, what do you want to do? And they most expected me to say, well, I want to be a fireman or an ambulance driver or all these sort of heroic things. And I said, well, I want to be a museum curator. Mm-hmm. I thought, blimey, what? But that sort of kind of followed me through into the current situation that I find myself in. I am involved in museum curation to an extent, To be quite honest, if I had said to myself at the age of 15, what do you want to be? I'd say, well, I'd be the most successful England cricketer, for all time. I'd be the greatest bowler, batsman, or fielder, or whatever, and that's not a, that's the way it is. I mean, that's the way the mind of a 15-year-old works, I think. Would I perhaps be proud of what I've got to, isn't it? Yes, I think I have. I mean, I'm not sort of being over, simplistic here, or over sort of, trying to stamp my own authority on this. But I think I've done pretty well, considering. I could have gone far in a different direction, in that sense. So
No, I think you're right that these things often do kind of work themselves out, that even if you'd gone to a different university to do your first degree, or you hadn't gone to Liverpool, etc., there's a good chance that there's a discernible Jonathan Trigg, that wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you kind of would be doing the things that you need to do, and it would all kind of level out. And that's why there's nothing for me more touching when people can say, when you haven't seen them in 20 years and they say, oh, you haven't changed. What they really mean is the same. It could be the eccentricities, the same values, the same kind of personality traits. And that matters a lot, because the people I would always be a bit suspicious of are the people who are the ones who, you think, oh, you're nothing like I remember. You're a different person, because then you think, oh, I put you on a pedestal, or I imagined, you were my best friend, and now I realise I've got nothing in common with you.
Well, if I'm honest, nothing really sort of makes me feel better than students who come back and say, well, thanks to you, I'm doing this, and it's, and generally it's a good thing. Generally it's sort of going on to do further study, or, master's degrees or PhDs, or even teaching, and that kind of sort of that really sort of enthuses me, because it says to me, you're making a bit of a difference, you're doing something, and that's the most important thing to me.
And my very last question, Jonathan, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, well, that's a very tough one, actually, because the two are interlinked. I think, yes, of course, one looks back, naturally speaking. I look back and think, this is what's made me where I am today. But then the sort of counterpoint is that where do I go from here to progress to the next stage? In that sense. I would say, as also someone who works in the past, I'm predominantly looking back, but always with an eye to the future.
No, I think you've summed that up perfectly, because, of course, in a way, as I've always discovered when studying nostalgia, nostalgia is really about the present, because it's about the perceived lack of something. And also, of course, is often what we then hope for in the future is a kind of a returning to something that
as we both know, the Welsh have a wonderful word for it, which is hyaeth. I think that as a word that belies any kind of translation or any kind of definition, it makes an awful lot of sense to me, because I know precisely what it means.
Jonathan, it has been so fantastic to catch up with you and talk about hyraeth and other matters. Thank you for being my guest this week.
No problem.